From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sixteen years after his contentious confirmation hearings, Clarence Thomas continues to be a subject of debate and speculation. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Kevin Merida and Michael Fletcher of The Washington Post about the paradoxes of Thomas's life and career. They've written a new book about him called Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Also, what makes a good husband, father, citizen, and soldier turn into a sadistic guard at Abu Ghraib? We talk with psychologist Philip Zimbardo, author of the bestseller The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. He created the landmark Stanford Prison Experiment, which was abruptly stopped after student volunteers in a mock prison turned into brutal guards and emotionally broken prisoners. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Clarence Thomas has served on the Supreme Court for 16 years, and in many ways he remains a mysterious and paradoxical figure, which is why my guests Kevin Merida and Michael Fletcher have written a new biography of him. It's called Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Thomas declined to be interviewed for the book, but Merida and Fletcher did speak with hundreds of people who have known Thomas during the course of his life, including many who had never before spoken with a journalist. Both authors work for The Washington Post. Merida is an associate editor. Fletcher covers the White House. They're both African American, and among the many issues they explore in the book are Thomas's constant struggle with his racial identity and the intense passions, often anger, he stirs among African Americans. Kevin Merida, Michael Fletcher, welcome to Fresh Air. What did you learn about Clarence Thomas's reactions to the fact that many African Americans consider his views to be kind of opposed to progressive African American views?
Clarence Thomas, you know, it's interesting. You get a couple of reactions from him on that. On one level, he says, I don't hear that kind of reaction from workaday African Americans as I live my life. People seem to be cordial to me in public life as I walk around and live my life. I don't encounter this kind of hostility. But he does say that, you know, civil rights groups and what he would consider liberal-leaning groups fan this perception of him, and that makes him upset. And in another way, he also sees his jurisprudence as being the best way for African Americans to make their way into society. He says you have to gird yourself, you have to become independent, and that's the only way you're going to really, really achieve in this society, and that will protect you from, you know, from anything anyone can do to you.
At the same time, you ask several questions at the beginning of the book, like, would Clarence Thomas even be on the court if he were not black? Why do you ask that?
Well, I think that one of the reasons is because President Bush, President H.W. Bush, when he, George H.W. Bush, when he nominated Thomas, said that he was the best qualified candidate. A lot of people cast doubt on that. I mean, this is a justice who had served 18 months in the Court of Appeals. He did not have a very strong legal background. Before that, he had served as the youngest African American to head an agency, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And so there wasn't the sense that this was a weighty legal scholar. So there was a lot of questions following Thurgood Marshall, of course, the guy who was going to replace Thurgood Marshall. Was there someone else who would have been of more stature to take that job? And because he was in a Republican administration that had not groomed many for that, and they also thought that Justice Thomas would put civil rights groups in a difficult bind. There's an entire political component to that. I think we raised the question, would he have been on the court if he were not black? If all things were given equal, I think even Arlen Specter, who is now the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, says that he disagreed with that statement then and disagrees with it now, that Clarence Thomas was the most qualified candidate to be on the court.
You point out that Clarence Thomas is opposed to affirmative action and any type of racial preferences, yet he benefited from an affirmative action type program at Yale. And you say every employer who chose him, at least partly chose him, because he's black, from Senator Danforth, who gave him his first job after law school, to his appointment to the Supreme Court. I'm going to ask you to just amplify on that a little bit and then talk about how you think Clarence Thomas deals with that paradox.
It's interesting. I think Clarence Thomas, you know, it becomes part of hypocrisy that some people see in his life. They say this is a guy, you know, some people use the analogy of a guy climbing a ladder and rolling the ladder up behind him somehow, and they think that Clarence Thomas has done that. Going all the way back, as you point out, to Yale, even at Holy Cross, he was the beneficiary, when he went to undergrad, he was the beneficiary of a Martin Luther King scholarship, and clearly the school after the assassination of Dr. King made a special effort to recruit African Americans. Now, Clarence Thomas went to Holy Cross as a transfer student and may or may not have been part of that special recruitment effort, but he certainly entered an atmosphere where African-American students were being recruited really in an aggressive way for the first time. From there, he goes to Yale, which had its own affirmative action program. And coming out of Yale, he talks about this a lot. He didn't have very many job offers, but he ended up taking a job in Jefferson City, Missouri, working for future Senator Danforth, who was then Attorney General of Missouri. took that job. He was the only African-American lawyer on the staff, worked his way through that, ended up going to Monsanto, and then followed Danforth to the Senate. And there, that's where his career really took off. And partially, you have to say it's because of race, and all of his employers acknowledge as much. I mean, he was appointed to be head of civil rights at the Department of Education. Then he moved over to the EEOC at a pretty young age and served there for a long time. And while serving at the EEOC, the White House kept an eye on him. They saw him as an African-American who could possibly replace Thurgood Marshall if, you know, Marshall were to retire. And they kind of kept an eye on Thomas and liked what they saw. And eventually, Thomas was appointed to the appeals court again with this kind of grooming process in mind. And when Thurgood Marshall did decide to step down, Clarence Thomas was in a position to be plucked, and race played a role in that. And I think Thomas, it's a tough paradox for him to deal with. I think what he does, he denies much of this. And I think he'll sort of draw a line between racial preference and kind of political expediency. He'll say that, you know, politicians make political choices all the time, and a lot of factors weigh into their political appointments, and race happens to be one of them. But that's different than saying, you know, race has to be part of, say, of a college admissions program.
Another question you raise is, were Clarence Thomas not a black conservative? Would his white ideological comrades view him as so courageous and be so in love with him? What are you getting at there?
I think that there is a sense that it is difficult for him, more difficult than even people who share the same ideology but are not black. The spotlight is on him, and he gets a lot of harsh treatment. So there's a sense of wanting to really celebrate him, let him know that he is loved. Ed Gillespie, who's the former Republican chairman, national Republican chairman, and was someone who tried very hard when he was chairman of the party to recruit more African Americans. He said that this was one of the most difficult things there is to be in politics, a black conservative Republican. And Thomas, as he points out himself, when he was in the Reagan administration, often he had to do battle against some of the policies that he didn't agree with, such as giving tax breaks to Bob Jones University that was against interracial marriage that Reagan supported. A lot of the civil rights kind of battles that happened inside the Reagan administration, Thomas would have been on the side, more or less, of civil rights leaders, but he didn't get that credit. So he's often squeezed. And because of his kind of efforts there and perseverance, a lot of white conservatives really embrace him.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Kevin Merida and Michael Fletcher of The Washington Post. Their new book is called Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Let's go back to the confirmation hearings, which I think really are still a pretty divisive issue in America. You went back and recounted Anita Hill's allegations that Clarence Thomas sexually harassed her when she worked for him at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Let's talk a little bit about what you found in the way of corroboration and contradiction to her testimony. You found a classmate of Clarence Thomas's who was never interviewed before. His name was James Millett. And what did he tell you?
Well, Terry, James Millett recalled watching the hearings and being struck by a particularly very graphic but sensational tale that Anita Hill had recited at the hearings. And Anita Hill, this is what she said. One of the oddest episodes I remember was an occasion in which Thomas was drinking a Coke in his office. He got up from the table at which we were working, went over to his desk to get the Coke, looked at the can, and asked, "Who has put pubic hair on my Coke?" Now, when they were students, Millett says that there was almost an identical episode in the dorm. He was in Thomas's room one evening, and a Coke was on Thomas's desk. Thomas walked up to it, looked inside, and said, "Somebody put a pubic hair in my Coca-Cola." Now, at the time, Millett just thought that this was a joke, and he, you know, tells us that he quickly shot back with deadpan humor, kind of, I didn't do it. But listening to Anita Hill's testimony, he's really struck by it because it was almost verbatim the exact same story.
What other new information did you dig up about the hearings?
Well, I think one of the interesting things for us was the degree to which a number of the people who really were ardent supporters of him, very insistent that Clarence Thomas, the one they knew could never have said or anything like Anita Hill alleged, would have never been so graphic or vile or any of those things. And now many of them, in our judgment, kind of back away from that. I mean, Senator Orrin Hatch, who of course is the Republican of Utah and was later went on to be Judiciary Chairman, but he was the leading Republican battling for Thomas in the hearings. This is what he said today. If you go back and put the worst slant, let's say you conclude that Anita Hill was right, was telling the truth, the most you could say is he talked dirty to her. He didn't try to seduce her. He didn't touch her. He didn't indicate impropriety. Now, back then, this is what Hatch said about Thomas's the allegations. He said he found it outrageous and, quote, unbelievable that anybody could be that perverted. I'm sure there are people like that, but they're generally in insane asylums. There's almost like a 180-degree turnaround now.
How do you think the hearings continue to affect Clarence Thomas now? Do you think that they're still with him?
Oh, very much so. I think when Thomas got to the court initially, he was totally exhausted. And in many ways, I think the hearings pushed him further to the right, or at least hardened his positions on the right. That's kind of our analysis of his situation. When he got to the court, he was dead tired, sort of worn out, beaten down by the hearings, and immediately confronted a number of kind of these hot-button social issues. There was the famous case of Keith Hudson, the prisoner who had been beaten in Louisiana, and Thomas's dissent saying that the prison beating did not amount to cruel and unusual punishment. There was an abortion case that came up shortly thereafter. So Thomas was, in many ways, just sort of, like I said, sort of beaten by the hearings and found a new embrace with the right, with some of his jurisprudence. He became kind of a celebrated figure on the right as a result of kind of where he stood as a guy who emerged as one of the most conservative members on the bench. So I think the hearings kind of set up this thing where Clarence Thomas became a hero to the right.
Why do you think the hearings pushed him more to the right? I mean, he called the hearings a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks. And you could argue that if he thought of this as a high-tech lynching, that he would have started to identify more with the liberal end of the civil rights movement. You know, if he saw this as an anti-black thing, as opposed to
I think he kind of saw some of the civil rights community as a villain in this. He felt that he was not protected by the civil rights community, and he points the finger also at liberal activist groups for basically attacking him and fanning Anita Hill's allegations.
I think also, Terry, you know, one of the things that his mother mentioned was that the NAACP, she sees them as kind of one of his enemies. And she pointed out to us that Thomas's grandfather always supported the NAACP, gave money back during the era when they were trying to beat down Jim Crow. And this is the thanks we get. Here we have this person who's risen and is, you know, really a product of so many struggles, and they turn against him. And that's her perspective. So I think there is a sense that they're on the wrong side of this issue, that just because he has certain viewpoints that they don't agree with, they would beat down a black man. So I think he really feels stung by that and really bitter about that.
My guests are journalists Kevin Merida and Michael Fletcher, authors of the new book Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guests are Kevin Merida and Michael Fletcher of The Washington Post. Their new book is called Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. One of the things Clarence Thomas is known for on the Supreme Court is not speaking, not asking questions. Can you talk a little bit more about his silences?
Yeah, it's interesting. That's one of the things that stands out for Thomas, for any casual observer of the court, anyone who has the opportunity to visit there. They'll notice that during oral argument, most of the justices, led by Justice Scalia and Breyer to some degree, fire questions at the advocates quickly. An advocate has typically a half an hour to make a case on either side of a Supreme Court case that's before them. They have a half an hour to make their argument. And almost immediately, once they start with their advocacy, the justices start to weigh in. They start asking questions. But Thomas almost never participates in that. And that's something that's been, you know, a puzzlement to many people. And Thomas himself has spoken to it, and he's given different explanations at different times. Partially, it's at one forum, at least, he said that he feels like the advocates deserve an opportunity to make their case. The lawyers who come before the court have this limited period of time, and the justices shouldn't butt in.
Although Clarence Thomas doesn't ask questions when cases are being argued before the Supreme Court, he does write decisions. Does he write decisions as often as any other justice?
Yes, he seems to, but quite often the cases that he's asked to write the majority opinions aren't the kind of headline-grabbing cases that really deal with the hot-button social issues out here. And much of that has to do with Thomas's jurisprudence. He's just not a guy who's interested in judicial half measures. He's not going to compromise. He has nothing to sort of give. So he's not the guy to go to write a carefully crafted 5-4 decision where you have to hold a majority. I mean, his legal views are pretty clear on, particularly on the most controversial issues, and he's very consistent with that, which is why the right sees him as a hero and much of the left sees him as this kind of villain. So Thomas indeed writes a lot, but it's his most vivid work is done in dissent or in concurrences, where he's in the minority and he can really speak his mind and talk about the lengths he would like to go to change the law in this country.
What's one of the most important decisions you think he's written, or one of the most outspoken?
Well, Thomas, I think, has been most outspoken in two areas of the law. I mean, he's been outspoken about kind of federalism, states' rights. He's a guy who would devolve much of the power from the federal government to state governments. He just believes that that's what the framers and the founders intended in setting up this republic. And also to Clarence Thomas, again, I think, and again, this has been in minority opinions, but I think this is where his very outspoken has been on a whole question of sorting people by race, the question of affirmative action, and kind of the moral authority he brings as the only black justice, I think, brings more weight to his views that society shouldn't look at race as a factor in even in trying to rectify the past effects of discrimination.
In terms of states' rights, Thomas wrote an opinion challenging the majority opinion in the case about whether the words "under God" and the Pledge of Allegiance violated the separation of church and state. And writing alone, he said that constitutionally mandated separation of church and state applied to the federal government, but not to individual states.
Well, that's right. And that was an eyebrow-raising opinion by Clarence Thomas. And again, it sort of spoke to his view of the law. I mean, as he sees it, perhaps, you know, states could, you know, maybe Utah could have a Mormon state church or, you know, New York state could have the Catholic church, be it state church. So he really has a very narrow view of what, you know, how the reach of federal law.
During Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings, when he was asked about abortion, because abortion was, as it still is, such a divisive and controversial issue and so pivotal for new members of the Supreme Court, he said that he had never engaged in personal discussions of Roe v. Wade, nor had he debated the contents of it. Many people found that unbelievable because it was such a controversial issue and because he was, after all, a law student. What was his role in the latest decision, abortion-related decision, about the Partial Birth Abortion Act?
Well, Thomas, in this case, as he has been consistently since joining the court, he wrote a short concurrence saying that he doesn't see a constitutional right for abortion anywhere in the national charter. And that's something he's been consistent about almost from the beginning of his tenure on the court, which surprised many people for a guy who, as you point out, during the confirmation hearing, said he hadn't debated Roe v. Wade, even though he had been a law student at the premier law school in the country during the time it was decided. So for him to have such adamant views immediately as a justice struck some people as curious.
The author of that landmark ruling, Harry Blackmun, the late justice, in an oral interview, he cast doubt about what Thomas said in the hearings. I mean, he kind of, in a discussion with the dean of Yale Law School, he says, well, didn't you guys discuss Roe v. Wade up there at Yale? I mean, he really had a certain suspicion about that, and I think that that suspicion was carried further by others at the time of the hearings, after the hearings, when one of the first cases that Justice Thomas ruled on, which was Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, a Pennsylvania abortion case, he sided with those who would be opponents of abortion.
Kevin Merida and Michael Fletcher are the authors of the new book Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement. Online at TIAACREF.org. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what makes good people turn evil? We talk with psychologist Philip Zimbardo, author of the bestseller The Lucifer Effect. And we continue our discussion about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas with journalists Kevin Merida and Michael Fletcher. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with the authors of a new book about Justice Clarence Thomas called Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Kevin Merida is an associate editor at The Washington Post. Michael Fletcher covers the White House for The Post. Let's talk a little bit about Clarence Thomas's background. He was born in a very small town and ended up being raised by his grandfather. Why did his mother give him to his grandfather to be raised?
Well, his mother was actually, their house had burned down in Pinpoint, and Pinpoint, Georgia, which is a small hamlet outside of Savannah where Clarence was born. He and his mother and brother and sister had moved to Savannah, where Thomas's grandfather was, by the standards of the day, a successful businessman delivering ice and wood and later fuel oil to people. But Thomas's mother, you know, later wanted to remarry, and this is something Thomas used to talk about more earlier on, back when he was on the EEOC, and essentially wanted the boys to be raised by the grandfather, asked the grandfather to do that, and he was reluctant initially, the grandfather, but eventually decided to take in his grandsons and raise them, and for Thomas, it was like a salvation. His grandfather was able to enroll him in Catholic schools, where Thomas got a fine education. And also, Thomas would work with his grandfather sometimes on the truck with him. And so he kind of taught him this work ethic, and his grandfather directed him to the library and things like that, and gave him the kind of almost middle-class opportunities that he would not have enjoyed in Pinpoint.
His mother was struggling early on to ask the question of why did the grandfather raised. His mother was struggling very early on after the house burned down. She was trying to make it on her own, raising both him and his brother. I think she was working as a maid and living in a tenement. And his initial years were one of struggle, and she just needed help. And Thomas saw this later on in a harsh light, because she had, you know, other men in her life that didn't pan out. And I think he saw it, as he told some of his associates later, that he just wondered why his mother wasn't there for him, more to provide him. And he thought that maybe she had chosen men over him. And that relationship, of course, tightened years later, and they have a close relationship now. But I think he really credits his grandfather with kind of saving him.
My impression from your book is that Clarence Thomas is not close with his mother and his siblings.
Well, I think that relationship has evolved over time. I think for a period there was some anger or some ill feelings, at least, because I think Thomas felt abandoned. And even he would speak publicly a bit about, as Kevin said, you know, his mother choosing men over her children. But I think Thomas has figured out a way to make peace with that. Part of this is that his brother Myers passed, and his brother was always kind of very close to his mother. And with Myers gone, I think Thomas has seen the need to draw closer, or felt the need to draw closer to his mom, and has done so. And with his sister, it's always been kind of a rocky relationship. I mean, I think one thing most people remember about Clarence Thomas is when he held his sister up as an example of how welfare could, you know, as she's an example of the debilitating effects of welfare dependency. I mean, he mentioned this to a Washington Post columnist back in 1980, before Thomas was a nationally known figure. And that's something that almost has come to reflect the kind of relationship they've had. And, you know, we've talked to people who said that Thomas at one point was ashamed of her and things like that. But I think he's come to make peace there as well. I mean, his sister says that, you know, Thomas has never been inside of her home in Pinpoint. That's her recollection, at least. But every year, most summers at least, people from Pinpoint, his cousins and family, rent a van and drive up to Thomas's place in Virginia and have kind of a reunion with him. So I think he's trying to put that behind him.
You were hoping to get an interview with Clarence Thomas for your book, but he declined to speak with you. I mean, it's not uncommon for Supreme Court justices to try to stay out of the press spotlight. But were you surprised that he declined, or did you expect that?
I think we expected it. But we were hopeful because we tried very hard. I mean, you know, we went to Georgia when he would speak. We would find out where he was going to be, dinners in town, and we would go see him and approach him personally. We wanted a chance to kind of see how he related to people and how he interacted, and we would always have cordial conversation. He was never mean to us. He would always just say, you know, I think I'll pass, buddy. Nothing personal, but, you know, your industry is really a bunch of scoundrels, he called us once, you know. Why are so many of you all scoundrels? And we, you know, we'd have conversations about it. They would be brief conversations, but he really had a kind of antipathy to the media that really is deep and ingrained. And I was struck, I remember, on a particular occasion at a conference in St. Louis, in which he recited to me the exact date of an article that was written by the New York Times reporter Ernie Holzendorf that basically talked about him being kind of, you know, in a sense, a product of affirmative action. And he said it was the cruelest or the meanest thing that had been written about him. And I was really struck because it wasn't that big a story, but he had this recollection of it. And it was a story that was written, you know, like in 1980 or something. And so he holds on to a lot of these slights. And yet, as you have mentioned a lot during the interview about the paradoxes, here's a guy who will call up members of the media and talk about their articles and has relationships with people like George Will and Juan Williams, the NPR correspondent, and others. So it's not as clear cut as that. And we know he's had members of the Supreme Court press privately up to his chambers. So it's very very complicated.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Kevin Merida and Michael Fletcher are the authors of the new book Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Coming up, a professor who studies the psychology of evil considers his infamous Stanford prison experiment and its applications to the abuses at Abu Ghraib. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Philip Zimbardo, has spent much of his career studying the psychology of evil. He's famous for creating the 1971 Stanford Prison Experiment, in which he created a mock prison and divided a group of student volunteers into guards and prisoners. Within a week, the guards became so sadistic that Zimbardo terminated the experiment. He thinks this experiment can help us understand how American soldiers became abusive at Abu Ghraib. Zimbardo was an expert witness in the court-martial hearings of one of the American Army reservists accused of criminal behavior in Abu Ghraib. Zimbardo is a professor emeritus at Stanford University and the author of the new book, The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. Let's start with an overview of the Stanford Prison Experiment. The goal was to assess how an institutional setting can override the internal dispositions of the people in that setting.
We went to great lengths to pick young men who were normal and healthy based on psychological tests and other assessments, and we randomly divided them into two conditions. Half would be guards and half would be prisoners. And so at the beginning of the study, we knew that we had only good apples in our bad barrel. In a very short time, the guards began to move into behaving in sadistic, cruel, dehumanizing ways against the prisoners. Prisoners who were chosen because they were normal and healthy began to have emotional breakdowns, extreme stress reactions. So I had to end the study after 6 days because it was getting out of control. I no longer felt that I, either as the superintendent of the prison or principal investigator, could control the guards. That is, their behavior is getting more and more extreme. And so we aborted the mission after 6 days.
Would you describe some of the behavior that you found to be extreme that was very concerning to you?
Well, the one thing I did is to tell the guards that a physical force, physical violence was not acceptable, was not allowed. And so if they touched the prisoner with their big billy clubs, it was equivalent of hitting them. There was some, in fact, physical violence on the second day when the prisoners revolted and challenged the guards. And the guards stripped them naked, broke into their cells, shot carbon dioxide fumes from fire extinguishers at them, chained them up, put them in solitary. And then after that, I said, you know, no physical force. What I did not limit is psychological violence. And so the smart college students began to develop creatively evil ways to first make the environment totally arbitrary so that prisoners could not figure out what they had to do to get the guards to not abuse them. And then over time, what happened is sexuality moved in, and that degrading the prisoners, first through nakedness, put bags over their heads, and then essentially playing sexual games with them, you know, having them play leapfrog, and when they're jumping over each other, their genitals are banging on each other's heads. Horrible things like that started happening, and at that point we realized, you know, this is out of control.
Let me point out the obvious, which is some of what you're describing sounds very similar to what happened in Abu Ghraib. I mean, there's a photograph in your book of several of the, quote, prisoners with bags over their heads that look not unlike the prisoner with a hood on his head in one of the Abu Ghraib photos. And you're talking about simulating sodomy-like positions to humiliate the prisoners. When you were watching this basically on closed-circuit television, what went through your mind when you saw the psychological degradation that the guards were putting the prisoners through in your study?
Well, see, I made the mistake of playing the role of prison superintendent in addition to being the principal investigator. I never should have done that. The problem was we had very limited resources. This whole study was done for like $2,500. And it was just me, two graduate students, Craig Haney, Kurt Banks, and one undergraduate who played the role of the warden, and Carlo Prescott, who was a former ex-convict. He was our consultant. So we had a very small staff, and we have to be there 24 hours around the clock. And so over time, you know, we also were under stress, and our judgment was, you know, not top of the line the way it should have been. But in the role of prison superintendent, you're looking at this and you're saying, wow, that's amazing that, you know, the guards thought of this creative thing. Your morality has changed. You don't step back and say, this is horrendous what you know, good young men are doing to other good young men. And so I was passive when I should have been active. I should have ended the study after 2 days. It only took 36 hours for the first prisoner to have an emotional breakdown. In fact, he was the ringleader of the rebellion. So here's this tough kid. He had been an anti-war activist at Berkeley, and he's broken in 2 days. And then each day after that, that became the way out of this alleged mock prison. Each day another prisoner would break down, either emotionally or develop a full body rash, psychosomatic rash. So within 6 days, five of the nine prisoners that we had emotional breakdowns. And so we ended the study, but I should have ended it after the first prisoner broke down.
Is it possible that the quote, prison guards were thinking that they were fulfilling your expectations, that you were expecting them to be sadistic or to humiliate the prisoners, and they did their job in kind of going to the extremes that you were looking for?
To some extent, what we created there was a system called the psychology of imprisonment. Before I did this study, I taught a course at Stanford with Carlo Prescott, in which we brought in ex-convicts and guards and wardens and prison chaplains. So we got to understand what is the essential psychology, what is the mentality of being a guard, what is the mentality of being a prisoner, and what is the psychological foundation of prisons. And prisons are about one thing, they're about power, they're about control. They're about dominance of some people over other people. Sadism is not part of it. That emerges from the power of the role. What guards have to do is they have to demonstrate to prisoners that they are powerful and prisoners are powerless. And that's the role you have to play. On the first day, nothing happened. I was going to end the study after the first day because it was very awkward. It was hard to get into the role of being a prison guard by these students. This is 1971. These are anti-war activists. These are civil rights activists. Not one of the volunteers, and we interviewed 75 before we picked the final 24. Not one of them said, you want to be a guard or a prisoner? They all said, I don't want to be a guard. I didn't go to college to be a prison guard. You know, I might be a prisoner at some time. So there wasn't any latent tendency to be aggressive, to be a tough guard. And so what I'm saying is the instructions I gave them had no effect on day one, and it was only when the prisoners revolted on day two that the guard said, these are dangerous prisoners. We have to show them who's boss. And after that, then the role took over and had nothing to do with any expectations that I had created in them.
When did you call off the experiment? What was the last straw?
Well, on Thursday night, we started on Sunday. This is 5 days into it. I had invited a number of psychology students, young faculty, to come down and interview everybody, give us an appraisal from outsiders who know nothing about this study of how it was going. And one of the people who came down was a former student of mine who had just started as a professor at Berkeley, Christina Maslach. And she came down, and it was 10 o'clock at night. 10 o'clock was the toilet run. It was the last time prisoners could go to the toilet. After that, they had to urinate, defecate in buckets in their cell. And what she saw was what happened in the toilet run. Prisoners were lined up, bags put over their head, legs chained together, you know, and marching, you know, counting off. And I'm looking up, and I say, "Hey, Chris, look at that." And she looks and turns away. I said, "Hey, look at that. Isn't that interesting?" And she starts tearing up and says, "It's terrible what you're doing to those boys," and runs out. And I run after, and we have this big argument. "Don't you understand? It's the crucible of human nature." And all that. And she said, "I don't care what it is. Those are boys. They're not prisoners. They're not subjects in an experiment. They are boys, and you are responsible for what's happening to them." And it was like a slap in the face. I mean, she broke through this illusion. And what's important is that at least 50 people had come down, a prison chaplain, a Catholic prison chaplain. Parents came down for visiting night, girlfriends, boyfriends. There were psychologists who looked in. There were psychologists on the parole board. There were secretaries on the parole board. All these people came and said, "Oh, it's really interesting. It's an interesting simulation. It's very realistic." And she was the one who said, "The emperor has no clothes." And so at that moment, I said, "You're right. We have to end the study." And then the other thing she said, we had just started dating. She said, "You have been transformed by this study, that you were a kind, caring, you know, loving person. And now I see this, you know, essentially authoritarian monster."
I should mention you're married now. You've been married for, what, 25 years?
35 years.
35 years.
We have a wonderful family, and she is, I dedicate the book to her as the serene heroine of my life.
What conclusions did you draw after terminating the study? And, you know, how do you look at it now, 35 years later?
We like to believe that all of human behavior is generated by things inside of us. It's all genetically determined. It's our personality. It's our character. It's our moral rearing. And what the Stanford Prison Study says, along with Stanley Milgram's famous Yale studies on blind obedience to authority, is that in many situations, especially novel ones that we're not familiar with, we can be transformed, like the guards, like the prisoners in the Stanford Prison Study. We can do things that are unimaginable to us when we're outside of that situation, so that we can be controlled by playing a role, by taking our identity away, by being anonymous, by dehumanizing the other person, so that social psychology tells us that although you respect the dignity of the individual does not always operate out of free will, does not always act rationally, that we are often subjects to the situation, and our life is all situations. We're always in schools, in families, in jobs, in prisons, in hospitals. So that Stanford Prison Study says, here's how powerful but subtle situational forces can sometimes overwhelm the best and brightest of us.
My guest is Philip Zimbardo, author of the new book, The Lucifer Effect. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is social psychologist Philip Zimbardo, author of the bestseller The Lucifer Effect. He's best known for his 1971 Stanford Prison Experiment, in which he created a mock prison and turned one group of student volunteers into guards and another into prisoners. The students playing guards became so abusive that Zimbardo terminated the experiment within a week. What parallels do you see between the Stanford Prison Experiment and what you've learned about Abu Ghraib? And I should mention here that you testified for the defense of Sergeant Ivan Chip Frederick, who was accused of placing wires on a prisoner's hands while the prisoner was standing on a box, and the sergeant told the prisoner that he'd be electrocuted if he fell off the box. So your conclusions about how a system can change a person?
No, in this case, the analysis is when we understand what were the psychological dynamics operating in that prison in Abu Ghraib. All of those that I've, in everything I know, says they're exact parallels, not only the visual parallels of the nakedness and bags and sexual games. It's the underlying psychological dynamics, dehumanization of the prisoners. Everybody is anonymous. Everybody's playing these roles.
So what did you say when you testified on behalf of Sergeant Chip Frederick?
Well, the first thing that's really important for your listeners to realize is he said immediately, "I am guilty. I did that. I deserve to be punished. I'm willing to die for my country. I don't know why I did it," because typically when you're trapped in one of these powerful situational force fields, you're unaware of how you are changing. In the same way I was unaware of how I changed in just 6 days as the superintendent of Stanford Prison Study. My statement was to say, here are the powerful situational forces that made this good American patriotic soldier, good father, good husband, good citizen, be transformed. And he's guilty and he's willing to serve time, but understanding the situational dynamics should mitigate the severity of the sentence. And that's all a situational analysis can do in our legal system. It had almost no effect on the military court. His sentence was 8 years in prison. He was dishonorably discharged. And then even they took away 22 years of his retirement pay. They took away his he had 9 medals and awards. He was in the National Guard and Army Reserve. And they stripped those publicly on the courthouse steps. And then they sent him to Kuwait in solitary confinement. So my sense was the situational analysis had no impact on the military. And in fact, the prosecutor in his closing statement essentially said that Chip Frederick, and the others, bad apples, rogue soldiers, really humiliated the military. And it was not about what they did. It was about the photos, because it was the first time in history that we saw American soldiers not only abusing prisoners, but putting themselves in the picture. And so these are trophy photos. These are like photos we saw in the past of Americans putting themselves in pictures of lynching. But this humiliated the military and humiliated the Bush administration.
The military has been using psychologists.
Oh, boy.
To consult with interrogators. Now, some psychologists say that this is very unethical and that it makes psychologists implicit in techniques that might be torture. What the military says is, no, the psychologists are helping the interrogators understand points in which they might be vulnerable in terms of supplying information, but also, how to not go too far, how to protect the person being interrogated. As the former head of the American Psychological Association, what is your personal view about that? And I should mention that a panel from the American Psychological Association recently said that psychologists participating in terror-related interrogations are fulfilling, quote, a valuable and ethical role to assist in protecting our nation, other nations, and innocent civilians from harm. So what do you think?
It's a very complicated issue. The problem is that psychologists want to help in national security. Psychologists want their research to be meaningful, and this is one area in which it can be meaningful. I draw a very sharp line, a very bright line between giving generic information about persuasion, about everything we know about compliance, obedience. And that's, for me, that's okay. It is not okay to give specific information about the vulnerability of a particular individual based on the psychological knowledge assessment of that individual to interrogators. That, for me, that's violating a basic principle of do no harm. That the person that is being interrogated is an individual who's innocent until proven guilty. And to give information to an interrogator about how to break that individual, for me, that steps across the ethical boundary. And there's a big controversy in the American Psychological Association, which I think is actually going to explode in the next few months.
Over this issue?
Of psychologists saying, no, this is wrong. The American Psychological Association should be condemning this kind of use of psychological knowledge, and other psychologists saying, no, we have a service to our country, we have a service to the military, and we should be doing more of it.
Philip Zimbardo, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry Gross, thank you for having me.
Philip Zimbardo is the author of The Lucifer Effect. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Luswing, Ian Chilog, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Former CIA Chief George Tenet tells his side of the story about the events leading to September 11th and the war in Iraq in his new memoir. We'll talk with Tenet on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Join us.